Welcome to another episode of Django Chats, a weekly podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. How are you, Will?
I'm great. Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And today we've got Nina Zakharenko with us. Hello, Nina. How are you?
I'm doing great. Hi, Carlton. Hi, Will.
Hello. Thanks for coming on. So, Nina, we always ask this. It's a good opener. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into programming, how you found Python and Django, and, you know, what's your backstory? What's your origin story?
My superhero. Oh, there we go. So I've always been interested in computers from a young age. I started hacking together my first websites on GeoCities probably around the time when I was 12 or so. And I had more of a traditional background. So I went to college for computer science and kind of went through that whole misery to start my development career.
Super.
Yeah, I have a ton of pop quiz knowledge about things that have not been helpful to my career at all.
Well, neither of us have degrees, so we, you know, empathize with that take.
So I started out my career doing enterprise Java and working for large financial institutions, and it took me a bit of time to realize that that was horribly boring and not how I wanted to be spending my days. And I kind of thought about what technologies the companies I did want to work for were using, and Python seemed to be a common thread. I heard great things about the Python community. And so at some point, maybe about 5 to 6 years of Java under my belt, I decided to switch to Python. I had a really hard time teaching it to myself on the side because it was just really hard conceptually for me to switch from using a compiled language full-time to something dynamic like Python. And so I quit my job for 3 months and I went to hacker school, now known as the Recurse Center, which is kind of a self-directed writer's retreat for programmers. And I taught myself Python over 3 months and then kind of haven't looked back since.
Recurse Center sounds amazing. I mean, at any stage in your career, I think the chance to spend a couple months just learning and having some colleagues, I mean, I'd like to do something like that now.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I recommend it to everyone. I went completely broke in the process because a lot of folks who had gone through the program had spent a lot of time planning for it. And for me, I was just like, I'm really sick of what I'm doing. I did not plan for this. But I think I need to go and make it happen. But, you know, kind of equaled out in the future.
And then you made your way out west from there, right? I think I first heard of you in the context of some of your Reddit work. And I remember it being like, oh, like Salt Lake City, like there's, you know, this awesome skiing out there. I didn't know there was tech out there, though obviously people know there's tech out
there. Yeah, they call it the Silicon Slopes, which I think is pretty cute.
You know, when you go and visit, you're like, this is perfect. Like I got to go to Park City for the first time last year and you fly in and 40 minutes you're there and...
Yeah, oh so I moved from New York City to Park City, and it was a shock.
Oh, you were in Park City? Well, because you can leave like Boston or New York in the morning, and with the time difference, you can be on the slopes by noon, which is actually true.
I did learn two things. Park City in the winter, I think, has a population of 21,000 people, but in the fall, when I had moved there, I think it was between 5,000 and 7,000. So I moved from one of the biggest cities in the world to a tiny, tiny city. And it was, it took a lot of adjusting. I'll say that. But
I mean, it's not the middle of nowhere, right? You've got the Olympic training facility there. I mean, I used the community like gym there. When I went out there, I had to take a shower, and it's like the nicest gym I've ever seen.
After 2 months, you've done all the things. And what I learned from living there, you know the people, you see the same people everywhere. I learned that the skiing in Park City was actually not that good. And Big and Little Cottonwood was where it's at. So Snowbird and Alta and Brighton. And so I would drive from Park City to Snowbird to ski like an amateur. And I moved the following year. But lesson learned.
Okay, that's a nice little interlude there. So I know you, Nina, from you're massive on Twitter, you're massive at the conferences, you've got all these courses, you've got talks, you've got things. So can we talk through some of the things you've done there? So, you know, one thing I want to talk to about is your DjangoCon talk from last year, where you about debugging. Was it Goodbye Print Hello Debugger was the talk?
Yeah.
And it's just fantastic, you know. I'll just rant for him a little bit about why I loved it so much, and then you can perhaps spin off from there. But you've been using the debugger for years, and then all of a sudden you just get, oh, you know, did you know you can use this little interact command, and then you can pull up an IPython debugger, and it's like, no, why didn't I know this? So anyway, I've been using that. That's been my new hammer ever since. So I want to say thank you for that, but perhaps you can talk a little bit about your talk. Tell the listeners, and we'll link to it in the show notes and things.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I'm actually in the process of recording a new and improved version of that talk for PyCon US. It's going to be released on the virtual PyCon 2020 YouTube page.
Okay.
Oh, great. So that'll probably be out when this comes out.
Yeah, I know quite a few senior engineers who still use the print statement to debug and to troubleshoot. And my goal with this talk was really to show people that the debugger is not scary, because I think a lot of people's first introduction to it is just like, oh, this is a lot of text. There's an arrow and a prompt. And what do I type in here? And how do I set this up, and what packages do I need to install? And there's so many commands to keep track of. My goal with this talk, like a lot of my talks, was to just kind of distill it to the basics. So what can somebody walk away with in half an hour where they feel not quite so overwhelmed by all of the options and all of the commands? How do they kind of get their training wheels on to start using the debugger right away, and then incrementally build on that knowledge in the areas where they felt like they had gaps? And I was really kind of shocked by how few Python developers use the Python debugger, because every time I give this talk, I think I've given it twice now, I ask people to raise their hands and kind of show, you know, how many folks in the audience use the debugger. And the first time I gave the talk, I expected the number to be 50, 60%. It was 10%. I was shocked. It's really not a widely used tool, but it is so helpful. I mean, it saves me dozens of hours, you know, debugging, working on a project. A lot of times I'll just copy code straight out of the debugger into my code base, because that's where I got it working. The first time I gave this talk, somebody afterwards approached me, and they were just like, you know, the head explode meme?
Yeah, yeah.
That was kind of...
The one with the rainbows,
yeah, like,
the 70s
one?
Yeah,
that was kind of their expression. Like, they were shell-shocked. They're like, oh my God, thank you for telling me this and explaining this. This is going to save me hours and hours a week at work. I can't wait to try it. And so I feel like I'm spreading the good word, you know, by giving this talk and sharing this information.
Yeah, no, and I think a little bit of debugger skills just goes a long way. You don't need to know all the minutiae. You don't need, you know, if you can just put in a breakpoint and stop it in a place where something's going wrong and examine a few variables, that can make all the difference. And then, you know, you can step up to that and step through code and back and up and down and, you know, move around the stack, and that's more advanced. But just to be able to stop it there, where you can't necessarily unit test because your code isn't structured right, but you can get the debugger in there and you can see what's happening.
Yeah. Should we give a quick overview of debugging to your listeners who might not be familiar?
Yeah, go on then.
Oh, I choose you, Carlton.
Oh, well, okay. So what do you do? Well, debugging, why do you put a print statement in? You put a print statement in because you want to see what's happening at a point. So you print a value. What you can do with the debugger is you can put in a breakpoint, and the code literally just stops there, and you get a little console. And it's not quite a Python console. And like a plain variable, you can type, you know, you could type it and it will print the representation of that variable. And that's kind of handy. And you can examine the variables in that point. And the thing that really amazed me from Nina's talk that I didn't know, and I've been doing the debugger for a long time, was that you can type interact. And that actually opens a Python shell. And it's like, and then you've got a proper shell and you can do whatever. Because to print an object in the debugger, you kind of have to use these arcane commands. And sometimes you can't examine the variable you want. But if you type interact and you're into the Python shell, you can just use, it's just the Python shell and it's amazing. And it's like, I don't need these crazy debugger commands. So that's fantastic. And anyway, you can then, once you've got your breakpoint, you say, well, actually, I need to see what's happening 10 lines on. And you can type the file name and then the line number, and you can set a new breakpoint. And then you can press continue. And it will carry on till it gets to the next breakpoint. And then you can see what's going on there. And with this, you've got visibility into your code that perhaps because of the structure or whatever, you can't get with unit testing. Ideally, it would all be perfectly unit testable, but I know code's not like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the fun thing is you can put breakpoints in your unit tests.
Yes, you can. And you can do things like assert false in your unit test, and then you can run your test runner with the PDB flag so that when it hits that assert false, it'll open up the debugger. And then you can print your variables. So say that, I don't know, you've got your unit test and you don't know what some variable is meant to look like, but you know what it's going to look, because you can just print it in the shell. And then you can copy and paste that into your unit test, and black will format it nicely. And then you can remove the assert false, run it again, and your unit test passed, and you didn't have to type it out by hand.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall how you found out about it and started using it? Because clearly it's not a standard part of what Python developers are learning. Like, were you reading the two things I can think of is some colleague happened to mention it to you, it's just like, oh yeah, you should do it this way. Or you were just, as a newbie to Python, reading the, standard library or something, and was like, well, this looks good, and didn't realize it was not widely used.
I've been using it for so long that I honestly don't remember. But I know that I came across the command line shell version of breakpoints first, and discovered IDE breakpoints second. And so a lot of my workflow around debugging still revolves around interfacing from the command line. But I honestly don't remember how I came across them. But the idea for this talk started out a few years ago because I went to a talk about debugging and kind of left a little bit less than satisfied. I don't remember which one it was, but the talk was just kind of an overview of all the commands. And so the talk was run this command and this will happen, run this command and that will happen. And I think I left more confused than I walked in. And I kind of always wanted to put my own spin on it.
Yeah, well, if you did, then certainly a lot of other people did, but maybe they didn't raise their hand and ask questions to, bring out the insight that the speaker could have shared.
And it's been kind of, the talk is just about half an hour, and I feel like everybody who walks out of it a little bit more productive, right?
With the interact command, it's been like, because sometimes it's difficult in the PDB command line. It's difficult to do exactly what you want to do because some things you can't type because they're PDB commands, so it's like, how do I now examine this? But yeah, as soon as you can drop into that's literally been a life changer for me. For 9 months, I've been like, every time I type it, I'm like, thank you, Nina.
I love that.
Even before DjangoCon, Carlton, I remember you were all excited about it, and I do recall that you and I gave our talks at the same time, and Carlton went to your talk, snap. Not to mine, though he'd gone to mine the first, and I was like, what better have been good? And he's like, I have to go.
Sniped. So. I'm so sorry.
I watched the video of Wills.
Yeah.
There's okay.
One it's, other
yeah,
thing I want to call out about the talk. There are some folks who've been doing Python for a long time who also walked away with knowledge about the PDBRC file, the .pdbrc file, where you could add some configuration and add aliases. And so one of my favorite bits was configuration, where you can set up the IPython REPL, a command that would allow you to open that up from your debugger. So letting you do things like the IPython magic commands, like cpaste, where you could just copy and paste in a whole code block at once. Like, that was my, when I discovered that, I was like, oh my God, I've been searching for this for years.
So you've actually just given up coding in an editor now. You just spin up PDB and just start typing in code in straight into PDB until it's finished and then print it, yeah?
Sometimes, yeah. When something is happening where I'm like, oh, what is going on or what does this variable look like? I just always reach for a breakpoint. Or, you know, is this code path being hit or not? You know, is this method being called? Just toss a breakpoint in there. There's no need to wonder or search through log files or anything like that. Throw a breakpoint.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
So I thought that was a nice segue, Carlton, because we did want to ask you about Visual Studio Code.
Yeah.
Since you work at Microsoft, you have a post, if not a talk on that. So I'm curious, how do you configure VS Code for your Django work? I'm sure there's some tips because I use it personally, but I'm sure there's stuff I'm not using.
Yeah, so the nice thing is, I mean, once you have the Python extension set up, you really don't have to do much additional configuration. You do need to to get visual debugging going in VS Code, you have to set up your debug configuration just once, but Django is already present in the debug configuration, so you don't really have to do anything there. It comes with debugging of Django templates out of the box, which is like...
Yeah, that's super nice.
Yeah.
Super nice.
That's one of the killer features and something that at least I haven't figured out how to do with a command line debugger. So if I need to debug templates, which I almost always do, I don't know why templates just give me a lot of grief. You know, the template syntax and...
That's where the typos slip in there. And it's always like a, you know, a percent or a bracket that's slightly off. For me anyways.
And so in VS Code, to be able to throw a breakpoint in a template and see what the data looks like that is just huge to me. It's saved me a ton of time. And then when I'm debugging more complex applications, the VS Code debugger is great too, because you can just hover your mouse over variables in code that has already been executed, and it'll just show you the value.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing editor. And I'm trying to recall, because I think it's only the last maybe 3 years where it was Sublime 2, and then, which is still good, but then it was a while before 3 came about, and then everyone got hopped up on Atom, which I still use and like from GitHub. And then VS Code came in, and I think, you know, I can say a lot of people's reaction was just like, yeah, that's from Microsoft, but it's so good.
Yeah.
That it's like, and it's got the built-in terminal, and it's, you know, since I saw it, I think maybe it's 2 years ago, I haven't really used anything else. And it's just sort of, to me, like, I know it's Microsoft said Visual Studio, I think for a long time, but it kind of just dropped and was like, wow, this is amazing and fast.
Yeah.
And free.
I was a PyCharm user for many years, and then I switched to Emacs for many years. And the thing that I...
Oh, really? You went that way? You went from PyCharm to Emacs? Oh, wow.
By the time I switched from Emacs to VS Code, my Emacs configuration was like so out of control that I was just kind of... I was sick of...
Well, you were using Emacs, so let's be honest.
I was. You know,
it's like when Linux people complain to me about config, I'm like, you are using Linux.
It was great when my config was minimal, but then I was like, oh, I need this and I need that. And then, you know, all the config is Lisp. So I had to look at a lot of Lisp, and it was my own undoing. I made my configuration too complex. If I had kind of stuck with the basics, I probably would still be using Emacs. But now I use an Emacs keyboard bindings plugin for VS Code. And the thing I really like about VS Code is it comes super bare bones, right? Like, it is, when you first download and install it, it's a really lightweight editor. And you kind of pick and choose the plugins that you want to install based on the kinds of activities that you do and the kinds of code that you interact with. So when you open a Python file for the first time, if you don't have the Python extension already installed, you'll get a pop-up that says like, hey, there's an extension that can help you edit this kind of file. And so you can kind of, you get a menu, right? And you get to choose.
Yeah, it holds your hand and kind of suggests stuff, which is really nice.
Yeah. You get to choose your own configuration, your own custom setup.
It's almost like, maybe all of us are old enough to remember like Clippy with Microsoft Word, which popped up and was useless. Yeah. It's sort of like actually helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot of nostalgia out there for Clippy.
VS Code is like Clippy, pretty.
So you have so much work out there. Is there anything else you wanted to add about VS Code before I switch gears?
At Carlton, I know you use it too. Do you have any?
Yeah, no, I use it all the time. So I have an old and first love, which is BB Edit, which is a Mac, mm-hmm. a venerable Mac edit.
Still good.
And
it's works.
It still works. I have it open all the time, but I also have open VS Code all the time. And there are things that VS Code, I'm typing away in VS Code. I'm like, I need to do this in BB Edit. So I've got a little homebrew BB Edit VS Code extension, which lets me pop the currently working file where I'm at in BB Edit. And things that I might put that online when I get it nice. But my JavaScript, anyway, another story. But yeah, VS Code. It's just super. For me, it's the speed at which it gets better, which is amazing. Like, it's, because it started off and it's like, okay, yeah, this is fine. This is interesting. And then it's like, oh, but there's this bug. And by the time you've worked out exactly what the bug is, the next version's come along and fixed it. And you're like, hang on, that's amazing. I saw this go past on Twitter the other day. Someone was complaining about the fuzzy search. And then, literally the next day or next week, the fuzzy search was improved. And it's like, yeah, that's where I think VS Code has... just so much momentum is that it's just moving so quickly. It's getting better all the time. And the language server that came in for Python just made it just phenomenal. And then Microsoft have just, they've got this PyWrite static type checker, which integrates with it perfectly. And it's like, it's just a smooth environment. It's lovely. It's lovely.
Yeah.
If I could ever get it to discover my test properly, I'd be happy now.
Well, you know where to send that feedback. You can send it to me and I'll make sure it gets routed properly.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Do you have a sense of how many people are working on it within Microsoft? Because my sense is it's a pretty good-sized team.
It's a fairly large team. I don't have the exact number, but the creator of the Python extension, it was developed by somebody else, Don... I'm going to butcher his last name, and for that, I apologize. It's Don Giamatti. And his software was kind of acquired by Microsoft, but he also came on board. So he started the extension, and then when Microsoft acquired it, they were able to build it up and make it this really great thing and have a team that now supports it. Something that I'm working on that isn't quite ready yet, but hopefully will be by the time the podcast airs, is I'm planning on getting about 4 folks from the Python extension for VS Code team to come on my Twitch channel every 2 weeks and do a kind of a community Q&A. So take questions through the chat, talk about any updates, any, sneak peeks that they can share from future releases. And I'm really excited about that. I did a pilot and, everyone who kind of came on the show and was able to interact had a great time with it. And so I think it's going to be a great way for the team to interact with the community and then for folks to also ask questions and meet some of the people who do the work.
It's been really nice to see Microsoft's commitment to Python. I mean, also in the realm of, the Windows 10, the App Store, now you can install Python, because it used to be a lot harder.
Yeah.
And even I had, I have a installpython3.com site. And one of the ways I was recommending the new way to do it, and I forget who, but someone who's on the team at Microsoft came in and made some comments saying like, yes, we recommend doing it this way as opposed to, I forget the other way, but also we're adding, there were one or two complaints some people had in a discussion forum. And he was saying, yeah, we're going to work on those. And, because it's just, they're just systematically removing a lot of the traditional barriers to development on Windows machines.
But you can install like the 3.9 alpha out of the Microsoft Store. And it's like, oh, that's kind of quite easy. That makes testing it more fun, and if, anyway.
That's awesome. Yeah, I've as a Python developer advocate at Microsoft, I've been thrilled to see the support and the presence at PyCon has been really great. So we've been a Keystone sponsor for the past Oh, I don't know. This would have been my third PyCon with Microsoft, but I believe it would be 4 years in a row as Keystone sponsor. And we have a lot of really fun and exciting virtual events planned for PyCon since we weren't able to meet in person. We're doing a lot of hands-on labs and online workshops that are going to be released kind of starting mid-April, going through mid-May.
Great. So we'll have links to that. There's also, we should mention, you and Carlton have done a video series on using Azure for deployment. That's from last year, I think, right? Right after DjangoCon?
Yeah, so we're using VS Code with Django, just showing you how that works, and then sticking your Django app on app service, provisioned a Postgres instance, and deployed the Django app to Azure, to the app service. They're all from within the VS Code extension, which is quite cool and super easy.
Yeah, we should drop a link to that in the show notes, because I think the video came out quite good. We got to film it in the Microsoft studio in Redmond, which is kind of a full-fledged studio with lots of cameras and lights, and we had a newscaster desk, and you know, it came out quite well.
Do you spend much time on that side of it, or like, if people have issues deploying Django stuff in Azure, can they reach out to you, or is there someone else on your team who's handles that?
Yeah, they can reach out to me, and I'd be happy to route the request and take their feedback. Usually the best way is to open an issue on GitHub, but sometimes it can be hard to figure out what's the right project, or you know, what are the right tags. And if it's something kind of more, if there's a bigger issue, I'm happy to route and to escalate and to help out.
I guess while we're talking about this, though, we should just talk a little bit about Azure, because in the cloud world, there's the three, right? There's Amazon AWS, there's Google Cloud Platform, and there's Azure. And a lot of people veer straight to AWS, and not necessarily the right option. You know, the others are good too. And I mean, I don't know what you think, what you'd say from the Microsoft stand. You know, what's the Azure option? I mean, for me, it's great. You can spin up a Postgres. You then got things like the app service. You can spin up compute instances the same as everywhere else. You know, it's if you're tied into Microsoft already, it's a good place to look.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a fully featured suite of offerings. We offer deployment and serverless functions and kind of all of the standard stuff. But I think where we really shine, and something that is really cool that the other cloud platforms don't necessarily offer, is we have VS Code extensions around all of our offerings. So there's a VS Code extension for web apps that lets you create deployments right from VS Code and do things like add environment variables, start and stop instances. So there's an extension for our serverless functions, and it's really nice to have a different way of interfacing with your cloud resources.
Yeah, and yeah, that's one thing I really like as well. Like the Blob Store extension, it's really cool because you've uploaded to the Blob Store. You can just, I'm going to edit my CSS online. You know, it's like when you used to SSH into your server and edit your HTML live, and you can do that all that again from inside VS Code. It's like, anyway.
Yeah, and I think it opens those services up to an audience that maybe is not necessarily quite as familiar with the command line and doesn't necessarily want to learn the ins and outs of a new command line tool. Some folks are just visual learners and visual explorers like I am. And so, yeah, to be able to interface with those resources straight from your IDE, you know, in a way that you're kind of already familiar, it's lives next to your code, I think is really fantastic.
Yeah, super. Okay, that's cool.
Well, maybe the last of the talks I wanted to ask you about is, so you did the closing keynote at PyCon this past year, I think.
Is that right? I did.
I mean, that's not really Django related. It was more about hardware. But mm-hmm. I don't know. We'll link to that talk as well. I thought it was really interesting in person. I guess, where do you find the time to play around with hardware too?
Well, it kind of started as more of a hobby, and then has kind of migrated to something that I'm able to focus on at work, which I'm really thankful for. But I started tinkering with hardware quite a few years ago. And when I discovered CircuitPython, that I think that kind of really reinvigorated my interest. It's a fork of MicroPython that's more focused on education. And so to kind of move away from writing Arduino, which is kind of more of an analog to C and C++, to writing Python to interface with microcontrollers, I just thought that was so fun and so awesome. We were going to be handing out Pi badges at PyCon for completing hands-on labs. I know. Unfortunately, that's not happening this year. We're going to be doing something virtual, though. So keep your eyes out. But I do have a whole CircuitPython repository available where if you do have a Pi badge, you can run it, and it had some fun Easter eggs in it and a little version of an expovert meter that I had written. Because I'm pretty introverted, but sometimes, you know, you're at a conference or an event and, you know, I love talking to folks and catching up with old friends. So there's an indicator of kind of where your social battery was.
Yep.
How many spoons you got left?
Yeah. With a little red LED and a little red message, you know, if your social battery was empty, or, you know, could display a green one if you wanted to chat with folks. So there are a lot of cool little things built into the badge, and I can share a link to that repository as well. If somebody does have the hardware, they can play with it and try it out, because, you know, unfortunately, Adafruit isn't shipping at the moment.
Yeah, well, because last year they gave everyone a chip. Well, a little bored. And so I remember going through the airport being like, you know, I'm sure you've seen a lot of these.
Yeah.
You know, because it is the kind of thing you're like, I just want you to see this thing. Like, it does look scary, but it's not. Anyways, it was a fun swag from last year. Carlton, you were going to say something?
What I was going to say was just that I guess the trick with this kind of thing is always getting the right hardware. So, you know, you go, you find an electronics tutorial and you buy your Arduino board and you start a kit and you get the ropes, you know, and you get it up and running, and then you're like, but I need this piece of kit which I haven't got. And
yeah.
So I guess for is there a, do you have a kind of, look, if you're getting started, buy this guide, because that's kind of handy, I think.
Yeah, well, so there are kind of two paths there. I think that Adafruit Circuit Playground Express, the device that they were giving out last year, is really a good all-in-one kit. It's a microcontroller, but it has buttons. There's 10 LEDs on it. There's a little slide switch and a whole bunch of sensors, temperature sensor, light sensor. So if you kind of just want one thing to get started with, I think it's a really good option.
Yeah.
There's also the BBC Microbit, which I think kind of has less on board, but is also a great option. And then kind of these days, if you're not able to get your hands on hardware, there are options for emulation. So MakeCode will allow you to use a block-based editor and have a Circuit Playground Express emulated. So you can learn about all the concepts without necessarily having the hardware. And then some of the interns who have interned for the Microsoft Garage have come up with a VS Code plugin called the Device Simulator Express. And originally that just simulated the Circuit Playground Express, but there's been a recent release, I believe last week, that added support for the Microbit and the Adafruit Clue Board. So if you don't have the hardware, you can still run CircuitPython and see how it would look on the actual device. So
yeah, and if you're waiting for the board, or you know, you can get the board later on, at least you're up and running.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know, so Bitsbox is something I see all the time for kids. Is that MicroPython? Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not familiar.
Okay, yeah, they and I guess just in my parenting circles, they have these subscription, well, they'll send you hardware things for kids 6 through 12. And I guess I was trying to more generally segue to teaching Python, because you have a course we'll talk about. But one thing I've noted is that, especially for younger kids, doing hardware-based things is a much more accessible way, a real-world way, because you don't need that much code, and you can do things like I think Nicholas Tollery was a guest and was telling some of these stories of you can create like a wand and have like a like an Easter egg hunt in a library, or you can use a tiny bit of Python code with a, you know, one of these chips, and it's just a great introduction to students. And I think that's being used more and more at the like late elementary, middle school level, rather than, you know, defaulting to building a video game or a website. So I don't know, it's just something I'm very much thinking of, and my oldest daughter is in that age group. But I'm so predisposed to think of software terms, but it's like, oh yeah, hardware, like a teeny bit of Python and I'm, you know, hashtag coding, but then you can like run around and make it interactive. Makes total sense that, especially for a younger kid, that would be a great introduction.
Yeah. I mean, there's just something exciting about making an LED blank.
Yeah. 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 It's, I mean, it's, yeah, it's a little more than just this, you know, your computer screen showing something or other.
Yeah.
You've got to teach them about the marquee tag. That makes sense.
Don't teach them about the marquee tag. Marquee tag is over. I think the first time I ever spoke, it's coming back. One of the first times I spoke about hardware at a conference was PyCascades early last year. And I did a few live demos with the hardware where I had a camera kind of pointing at the device and I would modify code on it. And I think I had 3 or 4 demos. And after each demo, the audience would just break out in applause. And I was like, wow.
Oh, that's possible giving a talk? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. I was not expecting it. But folks were like really excited and really amped up to see the LEDs change color and, you know, like, watch me program changing the behavior of the buttons. Like, folks were really invested in it, and I was taken aback for sure.
They're probably also impressed that you live coded and it worked, right? That's always like, right? Everyone who hasn't spoken before, they're like, I'll just live code this little bit, and you want to say it's not gonna work. So many ways it's not gonna work, but you know, you made it work. So
I had videos recorded of all of it in case it didn't work.
Yeah, right. So I was going to say that, like, that's the way to do it, like, is to have a backup or, I mean, I've even had it, like, Boston-related things where I always, like, throw a copy of everything online because just because, like, I have a MacBook and the person before me had a MacBook and it plugged into theirs doesn't mean it won't plug into mine. And, you know, not that I recall it. Yeah, I had to give a 40-minute talk just, that way. And I was like, I'm never doing that again. I'm always going to throw a copy up online somewhere in case my MacBook mysteriously doesn't work.
I did live demos for my PyCon keynote, and that was terrifying.
Yeah.
And,
funny enough, just a couple thousand people.
I did a practice run and everything worked great. And then on the day of, my camera was glitching. The camera that I was using to display the hardware started kind of glitching out.
Every
and
time.
It's like, well, all right, this is just happening. I'm going to roll with it because I'm here and I'm giving the talk. So,
I want to ask about recording for PyCon, because you're doing recorded talks for PyCon Online this year. So do you feel like the pressure is much higher to make something, you know, that the production quality higher? Because, you know, once you're on stage live, you've just got to plow on. And if your camera glitches, you've just got to go through it. And there's a certain dynamism to that. But if you're recording it, you can be like, oh no, I'm going to redo that bit 58 times until it's just right. Do you feel that? Or?
Well, now that you mention it, Carlton. Thanks for that.
Yes and no. I mean, editing is really time consuming. I think I'm lucky that I was already familiar with software to record screencasts locally on my machine because I do a lot of internal presentations that take advantage of that format. So I know kind of a little bit about video editing. I have a fair amount of gear for recording videos and for live streaming. So I've been live stream coding on Twitch for the past few weeks. So, you know, I have a reasonable microphone and good lighting and a nice camera. And so I feel pretty well set up to do my recorded talks. But I think if you don't have that background and don't have that experience, it's a lot harder and a lot more nerve-wracking because you might want to make it perfect or re-record or whatever, but you don't necessarily know how because the tooling is not that easy and not that straightforward.
I guess you've mentioned Twitch a couple of times. I want to ask about that as well, because I always think, oh, well, you know, I've seen people doing Twitch. I've thought, oh, could I do Twitch? And I'd be like, is anyone going to watch me reading the docs? Like, do you have to you sort of plan it in advance, or so that you actually do some coding, or do you just sit there reading the docs? I don't know. Like,
I don't. So there, one of the most interesting things about live coding on Twitch, I think, is at first I thought I would be productive, you know, as productive as I might be writing code on my own. But actually, I'm at least half as productive, if not less so, when live coding. Because
I mean, it's typing in public, right? That's always error prone 2x anyways.
Yeah, it's typing in public. I keep an eye on the chat and I try to answer questions and interact. And then sometimes we go down rabbit holes. So kind of setting expectations for how much I can get done, which turns out to be little bite-sized pieces. But I don't plan much in advance. And there have definitely been streams that are probably more boring than others. There was one where I forgot to set a callback URL properly. And so I spent, you know, 45 minutes going, why is this not working? And that's because, you know, it was a misconfiguration with an API that I was using. There was one stream where I read docs about the logger for the most part, right. You know, okay. And log streams and log filters. Yeah.
But I think there's real value in that too, both in seeing that even the pros, you know, miss stuff but more importantly, what is the process of debugging a situation? And I don't know, like I play guitar, and like John Mayer is a guitarist, and he does these live streams from home, and he'll just like noodle for 45 minutes and just like not miss a note. But that's not what programming is. Nobody does that.
No.
So I think, you know, it's helpful just to show people, like, here's Carlton reading the docs. Here's Will looking up on Google, and it turns up it's a tutorial he wrote 2 years ago. Like, you know, this is day-to-day programming.
Yeah, exactly. I remember almost nothing Google and Stack Overflow. That's my crutch. Lot of times it's just like poke it with a stick and see what happens. It was definitely scary making mistakes at first, because it's like, oh, everyone's going to think I don't know how to program, and how terrifying is this? But, you know, the community that I've built up on Twitch is very nice and very wholesome. If you come on the Twitch stream, you can get information about joining our Discord. And at the moment, I think there's just 40 wholesome folks who hang out in there and talk about Python, and everyone's really nice and welcoming and supportive. And, you know, I think it's good for people to see me make mistakes and, you know, the process of debugging and troubleshooting and figuring out what went wrong is really important to show.
Well, I almost think that having like a Q&A where people ask you a question and just seeing how you Google for it would be really valuable, or Carlton. I mean, because beginners just don't, and I often think as a teacher, how do I teach people how to Google better? Because it's a little slippery, but you know, I think there's some value in that, just seeing like, well, I don't know, but here's the terms I would type. Here's how I look at something and say, oh, this seems valid versus like, this is total trash. You know, how do I scan through Stack Overflow? You know, that takes a long time to get there. And I don't know of a linear way to do it other than seeing real people do it.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
Maybe that's on your next Twitch. People can ask you stuff you don't know and see like how you would figure it out.
Oh boy, that sounds like a pranking show.
No, but I mean, I'm serious about this, because I think, I mean, to your point about not making mistakes, I mean, I'm earlier in my coding career than either of you, and I've only just gotten to the point where I'm like more and more okay with like, I'm just never going to know a lot of stuff. And even if I knew something, I probably forgot it, but I'm not going to apologize for that because I can figure it out.
Yeah.
And, like, I think that takes a long time. It takes a while to get there.
Yeah, I think so too. The Q&A format helps. One of my favorite bits is when, you know, sometimes I make a typo or I do something wrong and somebody in chat is like, hey, did you check this or you forgot to do that? So it's kind of a different style of pair programming. I like to think that folks are like hanging out with me in my living room, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, so let's talk about your Learn Python course.
Sure.
It came out last year, links to it. So you have, this is on Front End Masters, but then also you have a lot of the curriculum online available. I was just asking before we started recording, you're using Grav Learn with a Hugo site for hosting.
Mm-hmm.
Is that so? So why the course, and what, you know, how did you determine how to structure it? Because I'm always curious on that. Like, I like that you didn't just dryly go like, here's data types, here's the Python flavor, here's, you know, operators, right? Because it's tempting when you're teaching to a fellow programmer who's on their third, fourth, sixth language, like, we know these are the constructs of computer science, and here's the Python flavor of it. You didn't do that as much. I think you made it much more, maybe I'm actually new to programming kind of style, which I, like, I'm, so I really appreciated that, but I'm curious how you got to that point.
Yeah, I didn't know that you had gone through the course before. You kind of told me right before we started the show. And so, and you know.
Carlton hasn't read my book, so I don't assume you've read my book. So it's
I have read your book.
Do you?
Oh. Yeah.
All three?
No, just two of them.
Okay, all right.
Oh, that's sweet.
That's still, okay.
Yeah, sometimes I recommend my course. Your wife hasn't read that.
She does listen to the podcast, though, so hi, sweetie.
Oh, it's so sweet.
Sorry. So how did you come up with the structure?
Yeah. So I have been an author on front-end masters, I believe, since 2014 or 2015. I did a course with Brian Holt on an introduction to web development, which I think is now pretty out of date. So it's no longer on the platform. I have a course that I taught on Git. So it's mm-hmm. a four to six hour workshop on Git, and people come out of it just like, oh my God, I never understood Git before, and now I know exactly what I'm doing. Like I'll have folks who see me at conferences, and they'll run up to me and be like, oh my God, you taught me Git, which is so like it's so touching and so satisfying.
And that's only two years ago, I think, right?
I think the Git course was 2 or 3 years ago. Yeah.
I mean, because Git is one of those things, like, I use the same kind of five commands, but, I mean, just yesterday I, you know, committed an API key with a demo I was making, which was which is a no bueno, and then I was like, you know, how do I totally nuke this and rebase and all these things, and I'm just like, oh my God.
Because
I certainly haven't, I should go through the course again, because I'm definitely like, how do I do that thing? Like, if it's not a revert and it's not a git commit or a push or a pull, I'm like, I don't know, I gotta look it up. And whenever it's rebase, I get scared. Or typing in, you know, --force or hard, then I'm like, it's like sudo, and I'm like, oh God.
Yeah, rebase is not that scary. Don't force push to a shared branch. So if you're working on a project with other people,
teammates
don't
love
force
that.
Push to master. And, you know, a lot of people don't know this or don't follow this, but just before you start fiddling with your branch, just make a new branch. You can just, from your current branch, you could just say git branch whatever.
Yeah.
And it'll just make a backup branch. And then you don't have to worry so much.
And I'll admit, I've gotten lazy in my own projects. It's just working off of master. And it's bitten me like twice in the last 2 weeks that I'm, you know, because in a team setting, of course I would create a branch. And, but when it's just me, I'm just like cowboy coding. And then it's like, God.
I still do branches and pull requests for my own projects, because then I can go back and review the PR and I kind of have a history there. But yeah, for the Python course, so these courses are available by subscription on Front End Masters. I think the current charge is something like $40 a month, but you don't have access to just my courses. There's a really full, vibrant library of courses available for one fee. It took me months to put my course together of just, this is something that I kind of do outside of work, on my personal time. And it definitely, ruined my social life for a few months. There's kind of an approach that I take to teaching, this approach of taking complicated topics and distilling it down to the basics. So, you know, I've done that with, conference talks on topics like memory management and Python and debugging. I've done it for my Git workshop, but Python was kind of a different beast to tackle, because every time I thought I had the curriculum right, it's like, oh, wait, I haven't introduced this foundational topic that will let the person make that aha connection at the next step. And so now I have to rearrange everything. And so the rearranging happened three, four times. Like, it took me a really long time to get the curriculum exactly how I wanted it, so that each concept that was introduced was the building blocks for the next one. And there was no section where you're like, well, this is a mystery, I don't understand how this works, because I was able to kind of build it up step by step. And I was really proud of how the course came out. I put a lot of time and effort into it. I was supposed to be recording a new course in June in Minneapolis, but I don't think that will be happening. It was going to be kind of a one day, you already know some programming, give me a one day of condensed Python to help me be productive after watching this course. So I don't know, maybe front end masters will be going remote. Maybe I'll have an update to share in a few weeks, but I love that people have a venue to compensate me for my work if they find the class valuable. When they watch the course on Front End Masters, it is something that I get paid for. But I know that not everybody is able to afford that, and there's still a lot of folks out there who want to learn Python, and there aren't a lot of good free resources out there. So I released all of my course materials and all the exercises under learnpython.dev. It is licensed in such a way where I really don't want other folks teaching my material, you know, because that's not why I put it out there and put it online. I really put it out there for individual learners who want to learn Python, don't have resources, and can't necessarily afford to watch the full recording. And then I also released my course and the videos for free for 2 weeks at PyCon last year.
Yeah, I remember that. That's when I first actually took a look through it. And then I just refreshed before this.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, because specifically like with Django, so part of the reason why I'm thinking about Python is because people ask me about Python in the context of Django. And the big thing that they have confusion about is object-oriented around classes and mix-ins and inheritance. That's that's the part where, you know, if you don't get that, then Django is really not going to make sense to you. And so I've read with particular interest how you handled that. So because you put that in the intermediate section, and I like also how you have practice things for all of them, because I do think that that's really helpful. And as a teacher, it's sort of like, how do you, you know, in a traditional classroom, you just assign it and people have to do it on their own. People almost never do these things. But if they are self-motivated, it is nice to have like a, you know, stretch yourself, and then, you know, the answer is out there, but, you know, really reinforce the learning by trying to apply it in a different context. I think that's, I really like doing that without doing some sort of like made up online validation quiz that you can just cheat on kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. And I think folks learn best with muscle memory. So throughout the whole video course, I encourage people to type along with me, because that's how they'll get it to stick. That's how the concepts will really, they'll be able to internalize them a lot better if they type along with me. And then all of the exercises, I walk through completing them with the students. So I think the video course came out really great. And I'm pretty proud of it.
You miss a lot if you just do that. Look at the text, for sure. I mean, I do think that typing along, I mean, back in the day, Zed Shaw's Learn Python the Hard Way, one of the real positives of it was it emphasized type all this stuff out and make it work. So I think beginners sometimes, you know, copy paste and all the rest, and that muscle memory is really important. I mean, that's in a way I've mentioned to people, they want to learn how to program. I'm like, you better be a good typist.
Yes.
Quite a few people aren't. Because, man, if you're not a good typist, it's something people don't think about.
Yeah, and that's actually a skill that you can learn. I realized that I learned to type the wrong way, and so I was going through some typing tutorials. You know, I type really fast, but the way that I type is not necessarily the correct way, and the typing tutorials really helped me minimize, you know, straining my fingers and like figuring out which keys to press with which finger and how to optimize all of that. So
it's painful when you see an educated person of a certain age using just their index fingers to type.
Yeah, it always makes me think of
I feel Halt empathy for them. Yeah. Yeah.
Halt and Catch Fire.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, Cameron exactly. Was like the index finger typer.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, there's tons of free resources to learn to type online. So even if you're not good at it, it's a skill that you can learn. And it's just same old muscle memory.
Yeah. One last question on the structure of it. So you go basic data types, and then you go functions, and then after that, lists and tuples and sets. So that's in the canon of Python teaching, that's the one where it varies quite a bit on like when do you introduce functions. So I'm curious, why introduce functions before you get into data structures and logic? If you recall.
Oh, I'm gonna have to think about that one. It's been a little bit over a year since I've put the course together. I honestly don't remember, but if I were to guess, it would be around the concept of arguments. So I think functions accept arguments, and then a lot of the data structures accept arguments as well. And I think it's easier to think about it in the concept of like a very simple function accepting arguments and then moving on to the more complex.
Right. A list doesn't really make sense if you don't understand arguments.
Right.
And I like that you also have you take the time to talk about function scope, because again, for someone who doesn't have a computer science background, scope is a gotcha. I'm sure, have you seen the Python tutor site that Philip Goh does? He's UC San Diego, that will visualize how the interpreter is running your Python code.
I've seen it a bit, but I have not used it on any of my own code.
Yeah, well, it's really helpful when you were talking about the debugger, I was thinking of it, because you can just literally step through and see, you know, how scope is executed from the computer's point of view. But anyways, just call out, I like that you had this specific section on scope, because I think that's often not included. And that obviously will get you.
Yeah, and I try to think back to all of the things that I found confusing when I was learning Python, and, you know, think back to the aha moment when I finally figured it out. So I put a nice illustration in there about how break and continue work with colored arrows and everything. And I was quite pleased with that.
Yeah, well, it's great. We're linking to it. People should watch the videos. And I find, not just as a teacher, but just sometimes I feel like I do Django more than I do Python. Mm-hmm. So even if it's more the beginner stuff, either I forget it or I just get a little bit different lens on it, and I really enjoy working through educational stuff. I always get something out of it, personally.
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that.
What's the Tai Chi equivalent, Carlton? What are the pose, the movements? Right, it's not a kata, but
yeah. Well, a kata is a kata, I guess, is a Japanese word.
Yeah, it's so, like a karate thing. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's the form, isn't it? So and yeah, the point.
It's like scales. The idea is
exactly. It's these basic movements which, you know, you might think, you know, 5 minutes, I've got this, but there's 50 years worth of depth in it. And it's about keeping your tool sharp. It's about always having, we've talked about on the podcast before, the beginner's mind. It's about being open to, you know, the fact that everyone's on their edge and you're on your edge and you're trying to make yourself better and sharper. And, you know, reviewing educational materials, it's always like, yeah, okay, you know, there's a new aspect I hadn't thought of. There's always every person puts it slightly differently, and there's always brilliant, thanks, yes. And it's, and what did it, oh, it was just list append, but I hadn't thought of it that way.
Right. Yeah, I mean, our mutual friend Trey Hunter has Python Morsels, where it's like weekly Python exercises. I mean, I play music, my kids play music, and that's why I have to supervise their lessons. And I often think, I wish that they're, you know, because professional musicians will spend a third, half their time throughout their whole life practicing scales.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wish that I did more of that as a programmer. I feel like I just, you know, airdrop into some project and just start, you know, putting out fires.
Yeah.
And I kind of wish I had like a ramp up of just, you know, hitting my scales in the same way I do on my guitar or the piano.
But is this not part of the obsession that we all have with tooling, right? And it's all like, I've got to have my tooling just so.
But that's the thing, it's not tooling. I feel like, to me, tooling can be a waste of time, can be a black hole. Whereas this is just like reps.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, and but not in like a, you know, leet code, like interview. I mean, those can be a little bit helpful, but I wish I, you know, spend half an hour every day just keeping my Python sharp, to be honest. I feel like it gets lazy.
Yeah, and it's foundational skills. This is something I picked up from Raymond Hettinger, but he always stressed the importance of being able to move between different data types in Python. You know, how do you quickly pull out what's in a dictionary into a list or a tuple and kind of fluidly move between all these different types, because all the types have different pros and cons and ways that you can work with them. And like, that is probably kind of one of my biggest takeaways, being able to move a list into a set and figure out, you know, well, you know, what are all the individual elements, and not even kind of think twice about it or have to think about, oh, like, which data structure should I reach for? That's been really useful in my day-to-day programming.
Well, I guess if you're a typical, you know, Bay Area startup engineer, you bounce jobs every 18 months, so you have to refresh those skills. So that's like built-in practice.
So that's like what, 1%?
Yeah. Well, we're pretty much up on time. Is there anything else we haven't covered that you'd like to mention, your work at Microsoft or personal projects?
There are a few things that I want to mention. We already covered this kind of in the middle of the podcast, but I really hope that folks can keep an eye out for the workshops and the labs and the tutorials that we're putting out for PyCon over the next few weeks. A lot of folks on our team have put an immense amount of effort into those, and I've been really happy with how they've come out. So unfortunately, we weren't able to bring our booth to PyCon, but we tried to digitize as much of that experience as we could so that we could still share it with attendees and Python enthusiasts. And the last thing I wanted to mention is I'm going to be kicking off some new live streams on Twitch. So one is going to be every 2 weeks, and I'm going to have a Q&A with the Python extension for VS Code folks. We're probably going to be covering different areas, maybe the debugger, maybe AIML. So if folks would like to keep an eye out for an announcement about that, they can follow me on Twitch at NNJAIO or Twitter at NNJA. And in between those Q&As, I think I'm going to do a series on Twitch called, I'm still working out the name, but I think it's going to be called Python Tea Time, where I'm going to have a new guest every 2 weeks. And we're just going to kind of talk about what they're working on, how they're doing, maybe any projects or news that they want to share. Because I feel like we all really miss the hallway track, you know, and just running into people and catching up with them. So this will be a virtual way of doing it. And since I'll be streaming it on Twitch, there'll be a chat and a Q&A so people can come and hang out and interact.
Great. Well, we will link to all those things.
Awesome.
So Nina, thank you so much for taking the time to hop on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
For
we talked
on.
About this in person at DjangoCon in San Diego last year. And so I'm really glad to kind of close the loop and go full circle and that we were able to connect.
Yeah. Well, we did, because we were getting drinks and I was like, Carlton, where were you? And we were all sitting together. He's like, well, I was with Nina. And I was like, you know, so that was the first time I think you and I ever spoke.
Yeah.
So yes, finally it happens. And you know, and to your point on the hallway track, again, this podcast came about because of my 2018 DjangoCon experience, where that's my first time going to a real tech conference, to be honest. And I love the hallway track. And I thought, how do we keep that going?
So. Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, no, thanks for coming on. Super. Okay, guess that's it. Join us next time, folks. Bye-bye.